on Project Director. We'll link to your piece in the New York Times. Headline, Trump has lost control of events in Iran. He's speaking to us from Geneva, Switzerland. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As a 10-day ceasefire has been reached between Israel and Lebanon, major questions remain over what happens next. President Trump announced the deal on Thursday.
It's very exciting because it's 48 years. We're going to be meeting with Bibi Netanyahu, as you know, and the president of Lebanon. And I had a great talk with both of them today. They're going to be having a ceasefire, and that'll include Hezbollah.
Over the past 7 weeks, Israel's killed nearly 2,200 people in Lebanon, including 172 children. Over a million Lebanese have been displaced. 40,000 homes have been destroyed or heavily damaged. Just before the ceasefire went into effect, Israeli airstrikes in the city of Tyre killed at least 13 people. Hezbollah is not a party to the ceasefire agreement. While the group says it'll observe the ceasefire, it's opposing the Israeli plan to keep occupying a large swath of southern Lebanon. Some residents of southern Lebanon have returned home to find their neighborhoods have been turned into rubble.
There's destruction and it's unlivable, unlivable. We're taking our things and leaving again. May God protect these young people. May God grant us relief and end this whole thing permanently, not temporarily, so we can return to our homes and livelihoods. May God protect everyone.
Many in Lebanon have questioned whether Israel abide by the ceasefire. After a Lebanon ceasefire was reached in November 2024, Israel repeatedly violated it almost on a daily basis. According to the UN, Israel violated that ceasefire more than 15,000 times, killing at least 370 people. We go now to Beirut, where we're joined by Karim Shahab, a Beirut-based journalist reporting on Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq for the Associated Press. Thanks so much for being with us, Karim, again. What has been the response to the announcement of the Israel-Lebanon ceasefire?
Well, there's certainly been a collective sigh of relief. This was a very, very intense war. It happened, the escalation happened so rapidly, it didn't sort of stretch out over a 7-8 month period like the last one. People, of course, are very skeptical of how long this, you know, this temporary ceasefire could last, whether it even, you know, last all 10 days and whether it'll be renewed. People definitely want a long-term solution and they want some level of stability. Lebanon's a country that has gone through so many crises and wars in its short and troubled history. That being said, the main division right now, the main dividing point among the Lebanese is really who is to take credit for this ceasefire. Was it the Lebanese government that held direct talks with the Israelis for the first time since 1993 on Tuesday? Or was it Iran, which included Lebanon in its set of conditions and its talks with Washington? Either way, people are, you know, visiting their homes, seeing, assessing the damages. I was just in the southern suburbs earlier. Widespread destruction everywhere there. People are trying to basically see if their houses can be fixed or not. But there's a lot of cautious optimism. But for now, people are at least relieved that there might not be strikes, at least at the same caliber as there was just yesterday.
Can you talk about the large swath of southern Lebanon that Israeli troops continue to occupy up to the Latani River and blowing up the last bridge over the Latani River, the significance of this?
Early on in this war, the Israeli military announced an intention to create what they call a security zone, which stretches from the UN blue line, which divides the two countries, all the way to the Litani River, which is, you know, almost some 20 miles away from the border. The Israelis were not able to push all the way to that that de facto border, the Litani River. However, they do control large swaths of southern Lebanon, and it seems there's a huge emphasis on the southeast, near Mount Hermon. This is very close to the Israeli annexed Golan Heights, which they took from Syria, and of course the Syrian border. It seems on the eve before the ceasefire, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said to expand eastward, and that's what we saw. The Israeli military and Hezbollah militants have been fighting in very strategic hilltop towns that overlook the border, including in Bint Jbeil and Ikhyam. And this is a very interesting sticking point, because the Israelis said they will not withdraw from what they call the security zone in southern Lebanon. But at the same time, there has been ongoing fighting until the ceasefire went into effect. In Bint Jbeil, for example, the Israeli military has, you know, the town largely surrounded, but there are Hezbollah fighters in there. And the question is that, you know, what's going to happen in there going forward? And of course, with this kind of military mobilization and this ground invasion in Lebanon, many Lebanon do fear this could lead to some sort of long-term or even permanent occupation, similar to that from 1982 until the year 2000. Now, the Lebanese government says that as negotiations continue, that they're hoping to, as soon as possible, get some sort of Israeli withdrawal. But at the moment, this is not part of the 10-day truce, and it is unclear when this will happen.
This is Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu confirming the Israeli government has agreed to this 10-day ceasefire.
In these peace talks, we have two fundamental demands. First, the disarmament of Hezbollah. Second, a sustainable peace agreement, peace through strength. In order to achieve the ceasefire, Hezbollah insisted on two conditions. The first condition was that Israel must withdraw from all Lebanese territory up to the international border. The second condition was a ceasefire based on a quiet-for-quiet arrangement. I did not agree to either of these. And indeed, neither of these conditions is being met.
So that's Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. A Hezbollah official told you the ceasefire was a result of Iran's negotiations with the United States, in which Iran insisted Lebanon be included. Can you talk about the significance of this and what the real value of these diplomatic talks between Israel and Lebanon is, orchestrated by the White House, but not including Hezbollah?
So this is definitely a major sticking point here in Lebanon. So yes, that's right. We did speak with Hezbollah parliamentarian Hassan Fadlallah, who, like Hezbollah and their supporters, credit Iran for their leverage in including Lebanon in their talks with the United States. Now, when Pakistan announced the truce between Iran and the U.S., they did mention that Lebanon and other regional wars that have been a sort of a spillover from this conflict would be included. However, this is something that Israel rejected and proceeded with bombing Lebanon. Lebanon, at the same time, was also horrified by the idea of Iran negotiating on its behalf and therefore tried to open a diplomatic track of its own. And that's when the talks started to take place. Now, what the question is really, what caused the ceasefire? What was the main turning point? Hezbollah says that the Iranians spoke with the United States and informed them at dawn, hours before Trump's announcement. However, the Lebanese say that taking these talks away from, you know, Iran kind of holding onto the Lebanese position, talking to the Israelis helped play a role, as Lebanon had been trying to use diplomacy for a ceasefire since the beginning of the war and early March. It's just that the Americans and the Israelis did not necessarily respond to them favorably from that point. It could be a combination of the two. We don't know that. But what we do know is that there have been efforts to bring about more direct talks between Lebanese and the Israelis. And our understanding is that the Lebanese president, when speaking with Secretary of State Marco Rubio, refused to speak directly to Benjamin Netanyahu. And that appeared to be something that they were trying to sort out before the ceasefire announcement. And he didn't do that, which also indicates that he is trying to find a way to appease his divided support base in Lebanon, many who are not in favor of developing any sort of diplomatic ties with the Israelis or high-level direct talks at this point in time.
Karim Shahab, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Beirut. Karim is a journalist reporting on Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq for the Associated Press. To look more at the latest developments in Lebanon and the region, we're joined by Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist and distinguished public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C. Rami, we began talking about the Iran-U.S. second round of negotiations went to this latest news of a ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon, though Hezbollah wasn't a party to those talks. Your overall comments on what's happening right now in the region, where you think it's all going?
Well, there's so many different dynamics going on at the same time within individual countries, among countries in the region, and between the region and the global power, especially the United States, but also China and others, and Israel, of course. My comments are that one of the striking things about this situation is that we've seen now in the last 6 weeks, Iran and Hezbollah almost single-handedly checking, not defeating, but checking the two biggest military powers in the region, which is the U.S. and Israel. They forced them into two ceasefires, one in Iran and now one in Lebanon. Now, this is not a finished story. This is still going on. This might collapse and the war may resume. But the fact that the U.S. and Israel have been forced to enter these ceasefires, I think, is a sign of the evolving balance of power across the region. And you're going to see this reflected, for instance, in many Arab countries, who are especially in the energy-producing Gulf region, who are going to recalibrate their relations. They'll still be very close friends with the U.S., buy a lot of weapons and buy a lot of tech stuff. But they're also going to recalibrate to have more meaningful ties with Iran, with Turkey, with China, with Russia and other people like that. So we're seeing a slow motion evolution of the entire balance of power in the region, with the background being that the overwhelming majority of people in the Arab region and Islamic Turkey and Iran, about 750 million people, the overwhelming majority of them see Israel and the U.S. as their main security threat. So something historic is going on here in slow motion.
And how does, Rami Khoury, these negotiations between Israel, the United States, Iran, and Lebanon impact the current situation in Gaza? Talk also about the role of the other armed groups like Hamas, the Houthis, if you can talk about what's happening across the region.
Yes, the Palestine-Israel conflict remains the starting point for all of these other conflicts. So Iran and Israel, Hezbollah's birth, Israel, Hezbollah, all of these tensions and conflicts ultimately derived from the unresolved battle between Palestinian nationalism and Zionism and the State of Israel. So it's crucial for any attempt to get a permanent peaceful situation across the region in the Arab countries, Iran and Israel. It's crucial to address the Palestine issue, which means right now looking at Gaza. Now, Gaza is in a situation of reconfigured colonial domination by the United States and Israel, with carpetbaggers from around the world like Tony Blair and others. I call it the joint venture of the carpetbaggers and the carpet bombers. They've all come together on this to dominate Palestine, destroy Gaza, and now they're looking to do the same thing in Lebanon. But the fact that the Iranians were able to pressure the Americans, to pressure Netanyahu to enter into this ceasefire is a significant sign that the group of movements and countries that have been involved in the so-called axis of resistance, which pushes back against Israeli hegemony and American militarism, that group of actors is still effective. They may not dominate the region, but they're strong enough to do what they've just done, which is force the Americans to force the Israelis to enter into a ceasefire that the Israelis did not want. The Israelis wanted to keep bombing and attacking and occupying and creating more buffer zones. But they've done that. This is the seventh time seventh time since the late 60s that Israel goes into Lebanon militarily in a big way, occupies land, moves millions of people around, and every time they've had to pull out because of the resistance they've met and because they could not achieve their goals, which is an acquiescent, passive Lebanese state that agrees to be a vassal state of Israel, and they still refuse to do it. So finding the negotiated mechanism to arrive at a point where the Lebanese have their sovereign rights and security protected, and the Israelis have the same rights, that's the big challenge that lies ahead. It can only be done if it is accompanied by a serious effort to resolve the Palestine-Israel conflict on a permanent and fair basis.
Rami Khoury, we want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian-American journalist, distinguished public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, also non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C. When we come back, we'll be joined by Alia Rahman. She's filed a personal injury claim against the Department of Homeland Security after ICE agents in Minneapolis smashed her car window, dragged her out and detained her while she was heading to the doctor. Stay with us.
Eva pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está cuidando que todo brille como una perla. Cuando llegue la patrona, que no se vuelva a quejar. No sea cosa que la acuse de ilegal. O se atiende los jardines, parecen de Disneyland. Maneja una troca vieja sin la licencia. No importa si fue taxista allá en su tierra natal. Eso no importa para el tío Sam. El hielo anda suelto.
Yellow.
Por esas
Ice.
Calles.
By la Santa Cecilia in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with Minneapolis resident Alia Rahman. On Thursday, along with her legal team, Alia filed a tort claim against the Department of Homeland Security over her treatment at the hands of ICE officers in January, when she was on her way to the doctor, instead came upon a street blocked by federal agents. Her window was smashed, her seatbelt cut. She was violently pulled out of her car. Alia described some of what happened next in testimony before Congress in February.
I was carried face down through the street by my cuffed arms and legs while yelling that I had a brain injury and was disabled. I now cannot lift my arms normally. I was never asked for ID, never told I was under arrest, never read my rights, and never charged with a crime.
Alia Rahman was brought to an ICE jail inside Minneapolis's Whipple Federal Building, where she was denied medical care. She eventually fell unconscious, woke up at a hospital. In February, she attended President Trump's State of the Union address as a guest of Minneapolis Congress member Ilhan Omar. Alia was violently removed from the gallery and spent several hours in jail, all for silently challenging Trump during his speech, challenging him by standing up quietly. Meanwhile, Republican members of Congress and the Senate were standing up, cheering, sitting down, standing up, sitting down, cheering. She just stood up quietly before she was taken out. We're joined now by Alia Rahman in Minneapolis. We're also joined by her attorney, Jessica Gingold, senior counsel at the MacArthur Justice Center. She's joining us from Chicago. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Alia, we have followed you on this journey. after you were ripped out of your car, after you were arrested in Minneapolis there, and then when you were taken out of the House chamber when President Trump was giving his State of the Union address. Can you talk about the claim you're filing?
I can. So this is an FTCA claim that I will let Jessica talk about the kind of legal details of. And it is the tool that is available to me. So I am doing this because this is a tool for accountability that someone like me can actually use against an ICE officer. And the American public has not seen any more accountability for the militarized violence enacted on our own people at the hands of DHS than we have for the violence in the war you've spent much of this show talking about. And I'm doing this because in the months since I first walked into this studio, you know, we have not only not seen accountability, but we've seen ICE wage disinformation campaigns against its victims. And we've seen this agency seek to expand in the United States, buying warehouses to house people and auditioning for a role in everyday life at our airports, at Marine Corps graduations, trying to be normalized. And to me, it is not normal to have an agency that is unaccountable for killing people handing out water at the airport, the same agency that weaponizes thirst at the border. I don't want to see these people at the polls. So for me, talking about this to the American public, talking about the type of claim that I hope Jessica will help me with a bit here, my hope is that Americans can see that we have an option that might someday make mass acts of racial violence seem too expensive for these folks, even if they don't share our values.
Jessica Gingold, explain exactly what this claim is, and would you describe it as suing the federal government?
I would describe it as the first step in suing the federal government. And thank you, Amy, for having us on today. An FTCA claim is our tool for accountability. It is basically we file a complaint with the agency that details what they did to her and how that harmed her. They have 6 months to respond to us. And after those 6 months, we can then go to federal court, which we have every intention of doing. The law underlying this is Minnesota torts. So these are we're just saying simple things like what they did was wrong and they should be held legally accountable. They battered Alia, they assaulted Alia, they were negligent in their medical care for Alia. All of those things are illegal, and this is our tool for making sure that they have to pay for that.
I mean, what you have been through, Alia, the video went viral of what took place. I hate to make you relive this, but it is so shocking what took place when you were away on your way to a doctor's appointment. Can you explain once again what happened and then take us on this journey? Because then you went to the State of the Union as a guest of your Congress member of Ilhan Omar. But start in that car. The immigration agent smashed your window?
They did. My driver's side window was actually open for them to use to open the car if they needed to. But yes, they smashed my passenger side window and yelled to both get out of the car and drive. So I was taken out of that car. You can see details for those watching in the complaint that we have made available, pieces of that for the press to look at. And so I was taken to the Whipple Center. The whole time I was telling them that I am a disabled person. I had been on my way to my 39th appointment at the Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic here in Hennepin County. I was not given the disability accommodations I needed. Instead of a mobility aid like my cane or wheelchair, I was dragged around by my shoulders until I finally was able to get a wheelchair and eventually went unconscious from assault wounds in my cell. I was removed from the detention center unconscious. By ambulance, I woke up in the emergency room in Hennepin County Hospital, the one I was actually trying to go to that day. And it absolutely has been a journey since then. You know, I'm not someone who even likes my picture taken or posts on social media, but it became clear very quickly that this had gone viral. And to me, that put a responsibility in my lap. And so really the next thing was that I was asked to testify in Congress about what I saw inside detention, about the experience on the street that you've mentioned. And really, people saw that video. But what was important to me was to realize that I had actually made it out of detention. I was able to come home. I speak English and people want to hear my story, and that is not the case. None of those factors are the case for so many folks who have suffered at the hands of DHS and, frankly, who suffer in our prisons every day. So I said yes to testifying in Congress, and since then, my life has been full of harassment, full of targeting. It's also been full of support and asks from people I don't even know to fight. So I was invited to the State of the Union, and, you know, there isn't really much more to the story than what you've said, right? I had stood up and sat down a number of times that night, just like you would see any congressperson do down below. The folks, the guests in the gallery, do the same thing. I was arrested, and ultimately, you know, the courts said that there was nothing they really could charge me for, because, again, no sign, no sound, not blocking anyone's view or the hallway. Yes, thanks for having us back, and I'm so happy to be here in this circumstance, because the night that I was held overnight in Capitol Police headquarters, they essentially, you know, uncuffed me from the wall, discharged me. I ate 3 slices of bread, and I came into your studio to talk to you in the same outfit I was in the night before, because I don't believe these things can stand. We can't have this.
So when you were in the car and they dragged you out, you were shouting, "I am disabled. I am disabled." And the agent said to you, "Too late, too late." This was in the car in Minneapolis.
Yeah, Jessica's confirmed for me that they actually said too effing late. I won't say the real phrase because I know we can't do that here live. Grab my body and drag me out. And so, you know,
and yet,
it looks like they actually escalated.
Also mm-hmm. taken out. You were also taken out of the gallery as you stood up and sat down like so many hundreds of people in the House chamber at the State of the Union.
Yes, and in the gallery, you know, because you're not allowed phones in there, so we don't have video, but there were actually at least 4 people who attempted to intervene in the way I was being handled. A doctor who was familiar with my case, Dr. Anita Patel, was up there. An attorney who said, "I really have some questions about what I'm seeing." A pastor, a community organizer, and they were all told that if they tried to accompany me, they would also be dragged out.
Ali Rahman, I thank you for being with us. Minneapolis resident who's filed an FTCA complaint, that's a Federal Tort Claims Act complaint, with the Department of Homeland Security over her violent arrest by federal immigration agents, and Jessica Gingold's senior counsel at the MacArthur Justice Center. Thanks both for joining us. And that does it for today's show. I'll be appearing at screenings of the new documentary about Democracy Now!, Steal This Story, Please!, here on the West Coast over the next week. It's continuing to play at the IFC in New York. Today at 1:10 and at 7:10, I'll be at the Lemley Royal in West Los Angeles at a benefit for Pacifica radio station KPFK. The evening may be sold out, but walk-ups are welcome at the 1:10 benefit screening. There'll also be a dinner benefit before the 7:10 screening of Steal the Story, Please. And I'll be doing the Q&A after the film with the co-director of Steal the Story, Please, Carl Diehl. On Saturday through Wednesday, I'll be in the San Francisco Bay Area with post-screening Q&As at the Roxy San Francisco's Mission District, the Rialto Elmwood in Berkeley, the Smith Rafael Film Center in San Rafael, the Rialto Cinema Sebastopol, and beyond. You can go to democracynow.org and see all the places I'll be. I look forward to seeing folks there. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in Los Angeles.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
You know why you listen to this station. It plays new music, supports your community, and provides up-to-date news that you know you can trust. And unlike other stations, the people who work and volunteer here are a part of your community. Remember, though, they do this on a shoestring budget. The solution is the Community Radio Initiative. You can find out more details at mycri.ca. In just a few clicks, you can generate an email to send to the politicians who need to hear your message. mycri.ca.